and welcome to another episode of the Podcast Surprise. Super excited to be here with you today. Today we are back to discuss season 3, episode 1, part 1 of season 3 of The Witcher, and I'm super excited to be here with my podcast mates. It's been a while, but we're back and we're excited to talk about season 3. So yeah, Mika, Alipa, Meep, and Hanaziz, and Kyle of it, all you all know that we have to have some funny names based off the characters of our story. And yeah, let's just get right into it. How's everyone doing?
All right. You know?
Mikal.
I like that. Okay.
Okay. Mikal's okay. Aziz?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Thumbs up.
Yeah, it is fun to be back in the Witcherverse, which it's fun to call it that now that there's, you know, like rumors and theories that they're going to make it kind of more of a Witcherverse thing. I mean, we've already got these dimensions and different programs and games and everything. So, hey, why not make that less meta and more directly a part of the story? But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
The WCU, the Witcher Cinematic Universe, they're calling it.
So just turn that M upside down, right? And there you go.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So yeah, today, obviously, season 3 has 2 parts, 5 episodes today. We're going to dive into the first episode, and we're gonna get into reviews for all of the episodes, and this one was pretty interesting, diving back into the Witcher universe. I guess we'll start with some reactions about how we feel about it, and then we'll get into kind of the nitty-gritty, talking about the character's development, the plot, the mystical things that we love to talk about in the Witcher universe, maybe some herb lore. They did have some interesting stuff in the first scene. we'll get down to the nitty gritty for all the stuff that you expect from the podcast surprise. So yeah, what was the reaction overall of the first episode for you, Mikal?
You know, it's fun to be back. It wasn't something that I didn't leap out at me as like, oh yay, you know, this is amazing. But like, it's, you know, it's definitely The Witcher. You get, you know, I think the vibes are pretty much the same. Very interesting to see Yennefer as like less of a ball of spikes, or like retracting her ball of spikes, and very fun to see the kind of the domesticity. You know, I think that's something that, like, if it had been in the book, fans would have been going crazy, you know, and like the chance to see that level of kind of contentment between the two of them. But it's, you know, it's fun. They definitely start with some intrigue as far as Yaskir goes. And I will admit, Ciri's kind of getting on my nerves, but, you know.
She's just a teen, Mikal. She's growing up, man.
She's such a teen.
Yeah, not quite the same as a precocious little girl. That is, there's a big difference there somehow, even though it doesn't seem that different. But yeah, I think overall I liked the season. Episode 1, maybe not my favorite of them, but they were addressing some of the narrative choices they made in season 2 and sort of getting themselves on a different path here, or having the characters move past their actions, I guess, is a pretty straightforward way to put it, given, you know, a lot of it is Yennefer getting forgiveness and them learning to trust her. And, you know, her putting herself in harm's way once or twice is a pretty good way to show that she's sincere, and spending all that time coaching Ciri and having a genuine attraction between her and Geralt. Like, you can't fake that. So it makes sense that they would get back together, and we knew they would. And they did, like you said, Mikal, the mealtime thing, the domesticity, it feels appropriate, not just for these characters and the direction they've been headed in, but that's a Witcher books vibe thing, to have mealtime and have it be meaningful. And it's something that is in the book equivalent of these scenes. If we're mashing together the ambush right before scene, which happens in the books, there's a really nice mealtime scene with Ciri and the dwarves, which we don't get here. Instead, we get this, which is pretty different, but it's still, you know, it's still part of that recurring theme of mealtimes, which is an important time for people to talk and have community and hash things out and have a good time. And yeah, it's a recurring theme in the book, so I like seeing it here, even though it's pretty different, which is something...
As long as they're eating fish. It has to be fish.
It has to be fish, right? Yeah, which is something they do off and on in the show here. There's a concept that I was introduced to, and I really wish I had written down who it was that I saw this from, because it's pretty insightful. Oh, well. The idea is that there's a distinction to be made between a faithful adaptation and a loving adaptation. And a faithful adaptation is when they try really hard to stick to the source material. And loving adaptation is when they clearly are into it because they know so many of these little details that you wouldn't know unless you really were into it. But you don't necessarily love it enough to do it the same, or you have to change it for other reasons. Like if it was a relationship, it'd be like, you can love someone and cheat on them. Maybe, I mean, your partner may not agree, but you can, in your mind, you can think that, right? Like that's a thing that people think. It's debatable whether that's really fits under the umbrella of love if you're cheating, but whatever, that's not the point. This isn't an actual human relationship. We're talking about an adaptation.
A witch and a wizard, or sorry, I say a sorceress and a wizard.
Yeah, right. This is more of a loving adaptation than a faithful one, right? So, and that's kind of appropriate given to the meta of what Yennefer has done in this first episode where they're trying to undo that harm. So this is them getting on a new path and reestablishing themselves. But it's also the show saying, look, this is season three. We've been doing this for three seasons now. You should know what to expect by now.
They're doing a vibe check in episode one is what they're doing. They're saying, here's the vibes of the season.
Yeah. If we're not used to the style, and I think of this particular way that they adapt the books, then, yeah, you're just going to continuously be frustrated. And that's valid. But I think it's consistent now. Like, the way it's been doing it, it has a lot of Easter eggs. It has a lot of nods and references to the book. A lot of times they're very just surface level, though, and that's fair to not be in love with that. But I like it. You know, it works enough for me. Overall, at this point when we're recording, we've done just the first five episodes are out. So for all I know, I'll hate the last three. It's unlikely, though. You know, I mean, I'm still doing this after Blood Origins. So.
We're all still here.
No, I mean, even Blood Origin is slightly better in retrospect now that they've tied a few things to it. It doesn't make it good, but they connect, there's some connective tissue between it and this, like the Song of the Seven. That's the same song that's like lasted 1,000 years, which is kind of cool. You know, or I guess it's because Yaskir was added to the framing part of Blood Origin.
I told you that was going to be in this.
You were right. Yeah, you're right. It made a lot of sense. It's like, of course he's going to have these songs. Why would he not? How could he resist not going into his catalog, you know? So anyway, it has its strengths, its weaknesses, and, you know, we'll probably focus more on the strengths even though we'll definitely drop in some criticisms because, of course, we will, but...
Yeah, we just don't want to be just all negative, and we want to actually give some analysis and why things are written the way they are and why characters are making the decisions that they make. And it's kind of, I want to play off that a little bit in that each season has a thread line, like a main theme, and then there's all of these other themes that kind of tie in with the main thread. You know, in the first season, you know, we were getting to know kind of people's origin stories and people were getting to meet each other. And then in season two, you know, they got together and they understood that they're all important to each other, but they really didn't mesh well, their personalities. And, you know, like Geralt is getting to know Ciri, and then there's this kind of disconnect at Kaer Morhen, Ciri's training, and now they're back together. And it's like, we've got to remember that there's going to be some healing and some change. And The Witcher is a story about destiny, but it's also a cyclical story and how things change and how characters change and how your viewpoint of the world changes. Certainly for Geralt, that's going to be a big thing. And Ciri learning about the world as well. And Yennefer learning about how to, change, but also be herself and express herself. So I think it's a really interesting way to, you know, look at episode one, in that they're setting the vibes right away. And this is like, hey, like, this is your trio. This is the trio. We're finally going to be starting to grow out these characters into the bigger parts of the story. And I mean big, because season three is going to have some big moments without spoiling anything. And yeah, and I think this, personally for me, this is where I get most excited about The Witcher, and my favorite parts of the story really start to take off. So getting to see them together, having a little meal time, getting those kind of moments where they, you know, you really start to feel like, oh, they really do love each other, is, you know, kind of the bigger overarching theme through all of the seasons. Getting those kind of crumbs at the start of episode one is kind of a really good way to start it off, I think. So yeah, episode one, Sherwood, Aziz, one of your favorite things.
You know, I love the flowers. Yeah, I like the story. The, you know, it's the fun aspect of having something semi-permanent that creates a way for the lore to be carried forward. You know, you have the roses amidst the ruined palace that has, it's an element of life that remains amidst this stone edifice that the elves apparently destroyed themselves rather than let the humans have. And it also gets to set the stage for one of the most recurring themes of the early parts of the story. The concept of neutrality keeps coming back. And yeah, they have that great conversation in front of it, and it's both poignant and funny, which is a recurring theme. That's a very much a something that Sapkowski has made his indelible mark on, which I'm glad that they have made a lot of use of. So
we could possibly all die, but like, let's laugh now.
Yeah. And the flower aspect has been used a lot just throughout the show in general, and of course, and the books. But you know, we talk about that separately in our book coverage. You know, Francesca has her own flower connection, and so doesn't someone else? I'm forgetting. There's a couple of characters that have you know, their stories wrapped up into things to do with flowers or certain herbs or certain smells, right? Let's not forget that one. And I like that they do their own version of it in the show, because you can't do all of it the exact same, you know, and keeping that vibe is cool.
So we got like little pieces. They really started to build out the Francesca stuff, obviously, with you know, her being a leader, and then them, you know, kind of allying themselves with Nilfgaard, which is something for you to debate whether you think that's a good idea or not a bad idea. And I ultimately think that we'll see the results of that going forward. But that is something that kind of plays into the elves storyline. You know, they got destroyed in war, and now they're entering another war, and we're seeing this kingdom Nilfgaard, which is the central, we can call them the big bad, but they're the central antagonist, really encroaching upon all of these other nations. And the elves, you know, there's not many of them left, and they're kind of just fighting for their survival right now. They're just fighting to exist. And that's kind of, you know, the struggle of power that we're seeing early on in season one. That's kind of what they're trying to focus on.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. In one way, it's almost a little petty, but that's kind of the point, that they've fallen so far that they're fighting over like scraps of food amidst, you know, amongst each other, and basically minor logistical concerns. You don't come off as a dangerous enemy when you have that going on. And that's part of why they're mad, because they recognize that themselves. They're like, we need to get our act together.
Like, I wouldn't try to usurp you from the podcast if you didn't try to feed me, but they're in a more dire situation here. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why they take big risks. You know, Francesca thinks that Ciri is their chance, and Gallatin thinks that Nilfgaard is their chance. These are both thin hopes, let's be honest. So neither of them are, you know, reaching for something that has a lot of promise. So it's easy but kind of, you can tell why the elves, the individual rank and file elves, might not be sure who to follow. And that it just comes down to the personalities of their leaders, because the actual goals are very hazy and uncertain. So I think that's maybe why Francesca comes back around and kind of maybe realizes that. It's like, look, we our only chance is to work together. And of course, when she says that, she is kind of being a little dishonest. She is kind of trying to just get him to go along with this thing because she doesn't, as we find out during the fight, she didn't tell him everything. And Gallatin's like, hey, wait, Francesca, on the other hand, already knows, like she's already worked with Nilfgaard. She already knows it's like this, that's not going to work either without being strong. Like Nilfgaard won't give them anything unless they can, unless they're strong enough to carve out their seat at the table. If not, they'll get squashed like everybody else.
Galton does bring up an interesting point in that, you know, politics aren't a good thing always.
Yeah.
And we, you know, Sapkowski obviously likes to play on real world tropes. He, you know, experienced a lot in his life in Poland growing up. So, you know, he tries to kind of play into some of those things that are going on here. But also at the same time, they kind of, it's like, what do we do here? You know what I mean? It's like, do we follow the leader who is going to lead us and kill people in war? Or are we going to continue to listen to the politicians who might not be as savvy and be able to fight and are calling us to do the shots about things? And we don't have that much food. So all these situations are making these kind of stark conflict when you're, you know, dealing with superpowers.
You're right.
I mean, I think a lot of this kind of comes from like, almost like the idea of Time of Contempt reaching back into season two, because like the death of Francesca's baby or the murder of Francesca's baby and then her actions where she, you know, killed a bunch of infants. Like that is very, to me, emblematic of like, of this idea that like everybody's down in the mud and like everything you do turns into like the fruit of the poison tree and everything you're fighting for turns out to be kind of stained with that. And I feel like that's a little bit part of the desperation in from her perspective, like, because she has no moral high ground anymore. You know, she is kind of just another animal kind of in this cage on the continent that's fighting, and like the only person who's above it really, and not above it morally, but above it like in a controlling sense, is Emir and the Emperor. And you know, it's very painful that nobody can recognize that, or at least they can't recognize it in the way that would lead them to getting out of the situation.
The thing that I think is so important about this too is that, you know, some people were like, well, I don't like the elf storyline that much. It doesn't interest me that much. But it goes really to the core of what Geralt is trying to teach Ciri. He's like, I'm staying out of it. Like, look at how people change during war, like, you know, money, power, war, all of these things change people into it. I mean, look at what happened with Francesca. She lost her baby and then she killed a bunch of babies, right? Like there's these reactions to all of these things that are going on. And that's why Geralt is like, listen, we need to be really prepared. I need to teach you about all these things before we make any decisions to get into this, because these are the kind of things that can happen. And that's why I think it's so important that we had that conversation right there between Geralt and Ciri and all of them. Like, listen, this is what happened. Like, this is a bad thing and it might happen again. Like, We don't really, there's three of us. What are we going to do about it? You know what I mean? And I think that that's super powerful.
Yeah, that's true. And it's really making, really leaning into that more. And I guess that's something that will be of consequence down the line, because of course there's a lot of story left and, you know, they won't be able to stick together the whole time. So yeah, they're making sure that's emphasized early on, I guess. It's kind of ironic too that Francesca would have an awfully good argument against Gallatin wanting to work with Nilfgaard if she knew and could prove that Emhyr killed the baby. It's like, dude, you're working with the guy that literally killed my child. But she doesn't know that either. So, However, I guess they, at least later in the season, maybe there's a vehicle for that, maybe to become information she learns, which would be interesting. We'll see.
And we start to learn much more about Emir and how calculating he is and how intelligent he is. And
yeah, and they're trying to give him a little more, I don't know, pathos isn't the right word, but there's that odd scene at the end where he's burning paintings, right? He burns a painting of Pavetta. He burns a painting of, I guess, his father, but not Ciri, who he kind of, you know, clutches. And Yeah, that was interesting. What did you think of that scene, McCall?
You know, it wasn't quite as subtle as I would have maybe hoped. But, you know, I mean, first of all, it's good to see more of Emir. I think it's satisfying to see him in the light that we know him and that the show now knows that we know him. Like, just to kind of brush away any pretense there. I don't really get if they were like, he's turning a path, he's realized he's doing wrong, he's turning away, but then realizes that Ciri is worth it, or if it was more like a, you know, I'm just burning the connections to my past and will go ahead into the future as, like, Emperor Emir, and then I can't do that because of Ciri. I guess for not being subtle, it was also confusing.
Well, he took out a lot of people that weren't loyal to him, and pretty much everyone is loyal to him now. They won't say shit to him, right? So I think that's a kind of smart way to look at it.
Yeah, well, there's a really interesting scene in episode two that kind of plays on that. But, like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's an interesting character to me, so I'm kind of happy to see him whenever he's there, because it's like, we just don't get that in the books, and to have that opportunity. But yeah, it did seem a little bit like maybe there was like a note, like, we don't understand what's going on with the Emperor. So they were like, all right, what if he looked at paintings and then burned most of them?
I do think it's good they are bringing him forward, though. Like, if we would have got, like, for example, that reveal at the end of season three, I think that would have been a little bit of too long of a wait. Because, you know, in books it's a little bit different. You know, we can read into foreshadowings, and we're creating this, you know, kind of image of what's going on within ourselves when we're reading it. But I think it's, you know, for a TV adaptation to bring one of the big antagonists of the story forward and get to kind of know him a little bit more and dislike him, hopefully, is important, I think.
But also to anchor him to our main trio specifically.
Yeah. And that he's connected to them in a very big way.
So let's see. Let's talk about Redania briefly. There, it's not too much of them to get started. Just it kind of kicks them off, and there's a lot more of them later in the season, obviously. But it's a great start to them. Philippa and Dijkstra have a great chemistry. I think the actors are really good together, and you know, there's obviously some changes here from the books, but at this point, just in episode one, it's not terribly substantial. I do like the idea of having Jaskier lean on them to go after Rience as a condition, which makes sense. It's the kind of thing they should be capable of maybe being able to do, and it enables the different plot lines to entangle each other in another way, in addition to the way they're kind of coming together for other reasons. So I thought that was pretty cool. And in general, I think it's one of the more promising parts of the storyline, and in part because of the strength of the characters that are playing the characters.
Graham McTavish is so good, man. He is killing
it. Yeah, and this aged up Radovid is pretty good too. I mean, we'll see what they do with it in the long term, but I like the actor. And I thought it was clever that he gets Jaskier to talk based on his friendship with Geralt. It's like a clever way to get information out of him, you know, like being like, ooh, tell me about this and that, you know, and the one thing that he can't help himself because he's a musician. And of course he loves Geralt. So that comes out in the lyrics. So I thought that was pretty cool. That's how Philippa kind of figures it out too. Like, oh, you're not too, you're actually kind of smart, aren't you?
Do you want to talk about the big change in his character? Instead of being a son, he's a brother. Kind of talk about that, a big change from the books?
Yeah, that's a pretty substantial change. I mean, I don't know that it's going to have big narrative consequences, because obviously in the book, it's more of just Sapkowski having fun setting up a character that for the future, just for world building, I guess, because everything that Radovid thinks is interesting and neat, but it doesn't connect to anything else. It's just like a fun little aside that he does. And I like that. I know that a lot of people don't like that in terms of how it's just so kind of random and doesn't connect to anything, and it just feels like pointless. But I enjoy that kind of thing when you get in other character, non-key characters, and have them have thoughts that don't necessarily have anything to do with the story, but are poignant and meaningful and would, in terms of they fit the character really well. And it is an appropriate way for them to react, even if it doesn't serve the plot.
I think it's interesting because without spoiling too much, in later episodes, we get a switch of a character death, which is also different. But I think that, you know, for Mikhail's sake and all of our sakes, we get more of Joey Beatty.
A solid change.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that they're giving Yasker a lot more agency, I think, than he has certainly like earlier in the books, where he really, you know, he's amazing. And I love Dandelion. For the most part, sexism aside, but like he is kind of like the follower and the hype man, as opposed to, you know, having an active kind of plot role. And yeah, it's really kind of interesting to see him as like a player on the screen, and a player who is making controversial choices, you know, who isn't just like purely, I mean, he is loyal to Geralt, but he has his own calculations. He's making decisions on other people's behalf, and he doesn't do that often in the books.
It's kind of like how they had to do that with Yennefer, and maybe this one has worked out a little better. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, obviously people have different views on the way they changed Yennefer for season two, but that was something that was more of an add-on, because it was it took more creation, more imagination to do that, whether you liked it or not. Whereas this is just giving Jaskier more agency in the parts of the plot he was already involved in.
Yeah. Just one thing that like kind of stuck out to me is kind of like an interesting adaptational change, and it's not a big thing at all, but like, I can't remember exactly when Jaskier gets struck with an arrow in the books. But I do remember that scene is like very, like, he is freaking out and like he cannot deal, and like it's a really interesting psychological thing, because Geralt like can't figure out why he's so upset, and then he's realizing like, oh, this is a person who's never been injured in battle before, which is something that Geralt doesn't even notice when it happens to him, because he's
so common. Yeah. It's part of the trade. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I will say I like that better, but I also don't know how they would have done it on screen. You know, like, how, I don't know how you get into his mind and be like, wait a second, I'm having this moment of deep empathy for a character, you know? So it was, I guess, fun that they kind of had him take the arrow in that scene.
I think that one thing that's particularly strong about a TV adaptation as well, and I don't want to always reference Game of Thrones, we always had these different POVs to kind of give us these different perspectives and, you know, different looks into why characters are making the decisions that they are. And of course, when you read a book, it's different, but getting more screen time of a character for a character like Yasker Dandelion is super important, especially, you know, with the theme of destiny, which we're talking about here. You know, Yasker having more agency in his decisions, you know, changing and growing as a character, and seeing more of that growth is certainly interesting and awesome. We're going to see more of that, of course, without spoiling too much, with Ciri and other characters too, but it is really kind of awesome to see his POV as like one of the main POVs, and kind of his character really starting to grow and get out there and interact with different characters, especially from the Kingdom of Redania, which is they have some quite powerful players like we're seeing. So,
speaking of Game of Thrones comparisons, the in front of the statue, it was a totally Rhaegar Jorah Mormont moment there, when he's like, Aelrin fought bravely, Aelrin fought nobly. But, you know, then there's that line about getting a statue, you know, which is, that's their own part, which I thought that was pretty well done.
And for those of you that are watching or listening, let us know if you're enjoying Joey Beatty's performances, Yaskier, so far in season three, as we continue to move on to discuss. Do we want to continue on with Redania, or do we want to move on to our next point?
Well, I don't know if I have anything else about Redania for now. It certainly,
I think there's more of it in the coming episodes.
Yeah, but I think for now it was just set up. What about the Beltane scene? That was, maybe, you know, it had its... Like everything else, I guess it had its pluses and minuses here. I liked the whimsy of it, and I thought it was fun to have the so-called climax of it happen in a maze. And I liked that Yennefer ran back the mask that she had from when they first met. And I liked the humor of, would it kill you to say, you know, you look lovely? And then he's, you look lovely when he sees Yennefer. And that was all pretty good. But also, they were talking about how they're really conspicuous and they didn't go through like any effort to not be conspicuous. And the actual fight was pretty boring. You know, he just kind of did one pivot and stab and it was over, you know. And how does that thing going to capture Ciri? They're trying to capture her, not kill her. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, Reince is a blunt instrument, but somewhat less blunt than like an armadillo mega truck monster.
I would have been dead in the first swipe. I wouldn't have done what they did. But it's interesting too, because we get those lovey moments between Geralt and Yennefer, and you know, Yennefer's really trying to get Geralt to give in, and he's just standing there, and he's like, I enjoyed all those times when we rode on that, you know, that carriage, and they're talking about all the different they mentioned the unicorn, which is a good nod, so the funny nod to that the fandom will really like. But yeah, I really enjoyed those tender moments too.
Yeah, I mean, they're ahead in the scene to begin with because it's Beltane, and like anytime it's like something in the Witcher is happening on Beltane, it's like Beltane.
Mention their birthdays. Don't forget their birthdays.
I really like Yarpin as like kind of like the fun uncle. Oh, let her have some fun. Like, you know what I mean? It's like let her drink, let her have some food. He's like, come on, guys, don't need to be so serious all the time. And then they go there, and the thing that Geralt is worried about actually happens. So it's like where suspicions are confirmed. Yeah.
Honestly, really, I mean, like anyone should have just come on that maze. It was a little. It's like, really, are you surprised? I will say, in terms of Yarpin, like, I do like him in the show, and I liked him in this episode, and I appreciate that they kind of take the kind of light commentary position from him and the dwarves, but the commentary that he is responsible for in the book is so emotional and so like has so much pathos that like, and he has a lot to say. He's like the alternative argument to Geralt's position on neutrality. And like, I would have really loved to have that, you know, be in there too. Also because like the dwarves having racism against them has kind of been a little bit elided in the show, and like it's kind of focused mostly on the elves, and it's really important what we learn from him about like growing up as a dwarf and suffering, you know, discrimination. And
yeah, and it makes it confusing in the fight because there are dwarf Scoia'tael, but it's really hard to tell because it's a bunch of people fighting and you don't know who half of them are, or even less than that. So like, having watched it twice, I'm like, that was a dwarf Scoia'tael. And I wasn't sure, or maybe a halfling or both. And because I was on the lookout for that, because we know that's the case in the books, obviously. It's a pivotal moment when Polly Dahlberg pauses, hesitates, and it costs him his life when the Scoia'tael dwarf doesn't. And yeah, so I totally agree with you, McCall. That was an unfortunate loss of an important thing. Maybe they'll make up for it later. But I kind of doubt it. I think they're going to use the Yarpin sparingly. And I feel like we may have already seen the last of him for this season, if not maybe for good, which would be a bummer. But I wouldn't be surprised if they just did that, you know, just because they've reduced his role pretty substantially, you know.
It's disappointing because he has one of the best speeches. It's like really powerful. Yeah. It's like, you know, helps you kind of put the chink into Geralt's armor about, you know, decisions to, you know, kind of go further, like from breaking off from the, oh, we stay in the middle. But yeah, if you stay in the middle and you don't do anything, that, you know, ultimately the decision is going to be made for you, friend. You know, so I think that's a kind of a powerful thing. I think they're going to, obviously, later on, we figure out more, and Geralt's going to have to make a decision. Obviously, they're in a more tough situation, but it is kind of, I agree with you guys, it is unfortunate that we didn't get that, because the actor is fantastic. Like, he's just funny, and he's got great delivery, and, you know, they could have taken, you know, a minute. They could have just slotted it and even made it shorter, and it could have been still impactful, you know what I mean? And Geralt could have paused and thought about it and be like, You know what I mean? You could have saw his emotional reaction to it, but they just didn't add it. So hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, they have like things aren't things chronologically, like, you know, different short stories have been later on, earlier on, stuff like that. So we'll hold out for maybe a bigger moment from Yarpin and him getting involved more in the
story. Yeah, it's definitely too soon to be sure that it won't happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you're adapting, you know, we all know this, like it's basically the story is like a drain and the center is your main characters. So pretty much everything flows toward your main characters and minor characters get, you know, shafted, unfortunately, partly because that's just how it works. But yeah, I think I thought it was worth, you know, mentioning.
I think the interesting thing enough too is that they did bring him back, which is a good thing. They didn't completely cut him out, which is encouraging. You know what I mean? And there are going to be bigger moments later on where things are getting more serious, where they could come back and have him be kind of like someone that inspires people and ultimately gives Geralt good advice, because you know he is someone that has been recurring. So I'm hopeful, and I think it's going to happen. So we'll see. But yeah.
Another thing I'd like to point to that I thought was pretty strong, or at least is a good sign, and I think there's more of it this year, and than in the first two seasons. Maybe I'm just not noticing it, or maybe I'm noticing it more now. Is that there's a lot more use of different storytelling styles within the season. Like there's the montages, which I thought, you know, whether you liked the need for it or not, it was a good time to use a montage of them moving repeatedly and getting, settling down and leaving repeatedly. I thought that's a good time to use a montage, and if you're going to do it at all, and for training and things like that, having looking at things from different POVs, like later in the season, the way they're using misdirection to make a certain character, a certain wizard seem like the bad guy until we reveal that it's somebody else. And, a few other ones. I'm sure we could think of some other ones if we put our minds to it, but I didn't need to list them all. The point is that that's a big part of the books is switching storytelling styles here and there, sometimes almost randomly. But if you like that quirk, then you want more of it, and having it in this medium instead, I don't know. I like that. It works for me, at least is so far the way they've done it. And I would be down for continuing to push that envelope a little more.
Would you say you enjoy the storytelling methods more in season 3 than season 2? If I had to ask you.
Yeah, I think I would. Yeah.
I think it's stronger, right? Like I certainly feel that way, but
it was just a tighter narrative too. Yeah. I mean, you have, I think all the plot lines relate to each other more, and that in part owes to the work they did in previous seasons. It's kind of like a lot of long-term stories or a lot of epics. Sometimes the setup isn't the best part. Sometimes it is, but the payoff, you know, this is more, there's more payoff here, even though we're still pretty early in the story, but there is payoff can start to come because so much setup has been done in the first two seasons.
I think we've always looked forward to season 3 though. Like all of us, you know, talk about The Witcher privately together and we have our discussions about things we like and dislike. And I think all of us were like, you know, season 3 is going to be a big season. You know, like there's going to be a huge climactic moment, which ultimately changes all of the characters in their past and where they go. And I think that, yeah, leading up to, you know, some may call it the biggest moment or, you know, one of the top, I certainly think it's one of the top three moments in the story that we're going to see. I think that's certainly the way the storytelling is leading towards that is making me perhaps more excited about kind of where the threads are going in the season. Like I wasn't, not to say that I did enjoy season 2, I did. I'm just more invested. I think I'm more invested in season 3's story and how they're starting off and where it's leading and where I know it's leading.
The actual fight itself, the ambush and double setup thing, was kind of similar to the books in some ways and different, very different in other ways, I guess you could say, like a lot of other plot lines in this show. They kept some of the structure while changing a lot of the reasoning or who's doing the thing. And you know, mixed results. I think some of it worked a lot. Like the idea of them not running, realizing they can't run anymore makes sense. Geralt saying, look, they know they're going to be able to keep finding us. We'll never be able to hide. So we got to go after them. That makes sense. But the idea of Yarpin agreeing to put all his people in this danger and use them as bait. I don't know about that. I don't know about, you know, Francesca just not using her magic in the battle at all, you know, and and Geralt, like, surely he could have broken Rience's neck instead of his hands, right? You know,
could have just killed him,
right? Yeah. But I also really liked other aspects to it, like when he sees the arrows fly through, and that's the reason he jumps back through the portal. He looks at the feathers on there. He's like, oh, those are elven arrows. Where, what the hell? Where are these elves? Where, like, when he jumps through the portal, there's no elves. So he realizes something horrible has happened. So that's a really cool, subtle moment, as well as the equivalent where he looks through the framing shot where he looks through the bars so he can kind of figure out where he is to come back later and realize where he's at, and or to show the audience that this is that same castle. And I also like how he overpowers people. It's funny, the battle was like backwards in a lot of ways. It was really impressive the way they filmed it. It was one long shot. But what I usually and what people often complain about with battles is that there's like people get hit in a way that kills them when they wouldn't be even close to dead, or they make decisions. They stand there and doing nothing until the main person attacks them. You know, the famous Chinese one at a time fighting style that happens in so many kung fu movies also happens on a smaller scale in a lot of action films and TV shows. That wasn't bad here. They did that stuff well. Like, Geralt clashes swords with somebody and they fall to the ground because he's so much stronger than them. And that is correct. He is that strong. So
he's so precise as well in his movement. Like, he knows, like, he's going like further, like art, like, you notice like in the choreography, like, he's like going right for their neck. Like, that's the kill shot. They're dead after that. Like, you know, he's not just like,
yeah. Yeah. So that was good. And that's the stuff that usually shows and movies get wrong. And they did this, that's the part they got right here. So, you know, ultimately, I thought I give it a pretty high grade, even though some of the stuff made no sense, like the thing about Francesca and how her. Oh, the other one was her brother grabs Ciri by the wrist, and Ciri still is armed. She has her sword in her other arm, like, and she's already taken out several people. And he's like, "I got her." It's like, "No, you don't." You know, and then Geralt kills him.
Stab.
You know? Yeah, like, it's like she could just cut you right now, you know.
Do you like the Sherlock Holmesy slow mo moments where they kind of slow mo in and it shows Geralt like doing the kill shot? I really like that, actually. I think it's pretty interesting. Like, it's like, it feels like, oh, that's the Witcher, like, you know, that's like a Witcher moment. You know what I mean? I feel like those kinds of fight scenes, like, they may do them in other movies and stuff like that. But for me, it's like, oh, okay, that's like a Witcher fight scene. Like, we're going to get some slow-mo moments. We're going to get some cool moments like that.
Spider-Man movies do that a lot, where to him, it is slow motion. So you see it from his perspective. So it's kind of the same thing. Like, Geralt isn't quite that fast, nor does he like do jokes during it, but like Spider-Man does. But it is, yeah, I think it's when I think of, or like the Matrix, I guess.
And they completely had to retreat. I mean, Geralt is a one-man army, man. Like, geez. Yeah, that was a cool. It was a one shot too. Like the way it was like weaving into is like really cool. It was a really cool shot. One of the cooler shots of the season.
Yeah, I recommend the behind the scenes on that. That was.
Is there a video on YouTube for that?
Yes, it's like a 5-minute him and the stunt coordinator guy, Wolfgang. I forget his name. I think that's.
He was the same guy from season one. They brought him back, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's him again. Yeah, they talk about it. And it's only like I said, it's like 5 or 6 minutes. So yeah, look that up. It's worth.
Me,
it.
I think Mikhail could kill us both with a sword personally.
I'm not gonna let her try.
Her spice.
Sorry, I just got distracted because Netflix is just like, coming July 27th, a new episode of The Witcher on my phone.
Nice timing.
Yeah, the trailers have been really well shot. I watched it twice today. I'm like, yeah, I'm excited. And then I was like, man, it's the 25th already. Like, summer's flying by, so yeah.
So did you guys think, maybe this is too obscure, but maybe we have, and I think that's what we're up to now. We've discussed all the main parts, the main plot lines. We can just talk about a few random thingies that we haven't covered. For example, I loved that great shot of Roach, you know, with the backlighting. It was just kind of random, but it was cool, you know? And then there was, did you guys think Gallatin was maybe like a nod to the Iron Wolf character, Isengrim, you know? There's even the betrayal. He gets betrayed like late in the books as well. So I don't know. He had a scar too, but a lot of guys have scars. Like half the characters have scars, so that's not really necessarily a big tell.
Interesting.
I think he might just be more the, like, if we're going to pay attention to the Skoytile, we need a face to, like...
Even, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I think with Amir being moved up early, they had to give him some more juice. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I liked the Ciri teaching Yennefer ice skating. They really leaned into the, like, perfect moment vibe with, like, that was a commercial where they're, like, her smile and her laughing. It was, like... A product should have appeared over that, you know, like some sort of, what are you selling here? Yennefer, you know. But also it sets up, you know, ice skate, Ciri on ice skates. It's like, ooh, yeah, let's.
Oh, I know what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, Geralt, you know what I mean? He only broke his hands this time, but.
yeah. And there's a, I appreciated the quick mention of Sir Laszlo, who was the knight that was protecting Ciri until Cahir shot him. That was who that was. Yeah.
Yeah. You're riding on horses. Arrows are pretty dangerous, huh?
Yep.
Don't take an arrow to the knee, but to the neck is even worse.
I appreciated the opening scene. It's almost straight from the books, right down to giving the professor blue glasses. And the difference was that, the professor is one of the three fighters instead of just a dude who talks. That's a pretty small change.
Talks and gets killed.
In the book, of course, it's, yeah. In the book, we don't actually see the fight. It's Applegat's POV, you know, the messenger. And he's just in the bar, and the professor walks in, and everybody's like, yikes, that's the professor, and Haimo, and the other person whose names I forget. And they're like, he's afraid to go, everybody's afraid. So they go outside and face Geralt, and it's over really quickly, just like it is here. And then he's like, Geralt storms in and yells very loudly that, I want them to know who did it, because he's trying to draw Rience out. So it's the similar kind of...
But Applegat's new. When he saw Geralt, he's like, yeah, this is over, man.
Yes. Like, that dude looks angry, you know? And that's... Which is from... He has no idea, but from a reader and a perspective, it's like, oh, Geralt usually isn't angry, but Geralt spends a lot of this book angry.
For good reason.
Oh, yeah.
For good reason.
Things get rough in Time of Contempt.
Yeah.
I mean, the word contempt is pretty contemptuous, wouldn't you say?
you're really onto something. Should we talk about our funny moments? Are we up to that part now? Did we miss any of our non-funny moments? Because it's usually what we do last.
Yeah, let's do it. I think we got pretty much everything.
Okay. Well, I'll start with one that is a good segue from what we often do with our book coverage is we occasionally do the humorous mistake made by the transcription software. Well, in this case, if you have your subtitles on, you might have seen when Ciri got to Beltane and she was so happy to be amongst other people and at a party, she said, gods, I've missed this. But the subtitles actually said, cods, I've missed this.
The fish have missed
she
it.
Really, yeah, the fish are still getting in there yet again. She's like, oh, I really need some fish, you know.
Sorry, I was going to say the boulder parchment dagger was a cool nod to rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, instead of rock, paper, scissors. That was really good. And the context for that too, where they're just like, they're trading off, like, who's gonna do this awful spy thing, you know, like, let's rock with boulder parchment dagger for it. Like, oh, that's pretty funny. Or when Radovid calls Philip a pip.
That was great. Yeah, she's like
pip.
And a woman with a strong presence, just like, man, do you really want to piss her off? Like, dude, she's one of the most powerful sorceresses there is, dude. Chill.
Yennefer, like, in one of her letters, the dear friend is a good example of them taking something from the book, and, you know, it's not at all like the way they did it, use it in the book, but it is at least a letter from, you know, in this case, multiple letters back and forth. But anyway, she says, she makes this line. She says, things keep coming at us fast and furious. And it was like, are you making a Fast and Furious joke? Because it was wrapped up in like them talking about their found family, which is like the big theme of Fast and the Furious movies. So that might have been like them being silly there, but I hope that wasn't, you know, earnest.
it'll end with like, you don't need wings.
Yeah.
What was your favorite funny moment, Mikael?
I mean, I honestly, like, I just found it funny with the entry into Dear Friend, because they know how much obviously that means and what readers are bringing to it. But what's his name? Vizimir, the king? Just his perpetual idiocy and the like, oh, we didn't kill that baby, did we? Like, that is just, oh man.
He's always aloof. He's always like, oh. And he's just sarcastic and asshole-y about it too. You know what I mean? He's just like, he's the king, I guess.
Yeah, it's very much like, I enjoy that they're doing the like, everyone around him can have a personality. He's just an asshole. Like, you don't have to feel anything. It's fine.
I do love when Yennefer was leaving the letters and like kind of slamming them in. It's like, oh, but it's also kind of funny because it was like, you know, there's like this tension, and then Geralt he like opens his door. He's like, yeah, he's like grabbing them. I just find it super funny, even though they're like right next to each other. You know what I mean? They're communicating. So it is kind of funny. There's this tension. There's the letters, and obviously the, you know, it's serious because they're trying to mend their relationship, but it is funny because, like, you know, their relationship does have like really funny moments and stuff too. So like, for them to kind of lean into that was great.
Yeah, and it's sweet that it resolves with him putting it in her bedroll, the last letter.
Yeah, I liked that. I liked the montage joke at the beginning when they reuse the trope that is in every fantasy or medieval show ever, where the amount of money in the bag is the exact right amount without anyone ever having to count it or know in advance. And it is very often clearly isn't a bag of coins. It's just, you know, it's like something else is in there because it doesn't
some hang nuts,
like
maybe
a bag of coins at all. Yeah, like Geralt, multiple times Geralt's like, he hands someone a bag of money and is like, for your discretion. And when it comes to, when they go to Yarpin, Yarpin's like, and I expect payment for my discretion.
It's funny how they always drop it on the table too. It's like, it's always like that in fantasy. You got to hear the clink, got to hear the clink of the coins on the table to make it sure that you know that it's coins, right?
Yeah. I like too the recycling of the Vespula and that plot line in that little scene, you know, with, that was really cool because they right down to like, she doesn't have a crossbow up there, does she? Like, that's right from the book, except it's Geralt saying it instead of Philippa. So that's an odd, you know, piece situation to have Philippa have one of Geralt's lines. Like, you wouldn't expect that one. Maybe it's like, maybe Yaskier say something that Yennefer says, or Ciri says something that Geralt says, but Philippa says something that Geralt says. Is like, that's cool. Well, they've done a good job there.
I also really like the representation of open relationship they, you know, with Vespula and Yaskier and the dynamic of that. Like, people obviously think, Yaskier is getting kicked out of the house. You know what I mean? But then there's a lot more to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like a bard and a lovely lady have this relationship. This quite curious, but she certainly knows about Yaskier's quirks, apparently, right? So she's accepting of them.
The detail of the loot being the only important thing. Just don't hurt the loot.
Don't hurt the loot. Yeah.
Yeah. They just really leaned into it. They're like, we're not just going to have Philippa in this scene instead of Geralt. We're going to have Radovid come in here as well, and he'll catch the loot, and that'll be, yeah.
And he's observing all of it like, this is really dumb, but funny. You know what I mean? He's like, he's like laughing at Yaskier that he's deservingly getting the whip.
another great line from Yarpin was, you should wear a wig, they're not looking for the black wolf, which we were just saying that regarding the Beltane. Like, yeah, wear a wig, man. You're so, like, he doesn't even hide his Witcher medallion. Like, put that under your shirt at least.
He's like really trying to tell him, like, man, like, you're a huge dude. You've got white hair. You got a Witcher medallion, and you got like the eyes of a Witcher. You think they're not going to find you? Like, it's just so funny.
The only other line I have that I took note of, unless I missed something in my notes here, is the when another one by Yarp, and he says, "Hold up, Buttercup," which I'm like, "Hey, is that a nod to the actual translation of Jaskier?
Because
it's Buttercup
it
instead of Dandelion." Yeah. Sneaky, sneaky. So that's that, coming back to what I said about faithful versus loving adaptations, like. Those kind of details, like the professor having blue glasses and a nod to Buttercup, like those are not things you don't, those aren't things you put in unless you're aware of them. And you're only aware of those things if you're like a pretty big fan, you know, like I don't think you catch those. You don't know those things from having a surface level understanding of the series. So while we can disagree with some of their interpretations and adaptations, I don't think there's much doubt that weird news item going around that some of the writers don't even like the books. I don't think that was true. I think that was just an exaggeration of maybe they didn't like certain parts or certain aspects of it.
You know who doesn't like Star Wars? Tony Gilroy.
Tony Gilroy yeah, he wrote Andor. Yeah.
So
yeah, even if you're right. So even if it is true, it doesn't mean they can't do a really good job.
I felt season 3's writing was particularly strong. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Javier Grillo, I cannot ever pronounce his last name, but Grillo Marchuar or something like that, is on staff also, and he's amazing. He's like a genre staple, and he's, yeah, wonderful.
So yeah, that will do it for our coverage of episode 1 of season 3 of The Witcher. If you made it this far, thank you very much for watching. We certainly appreciate that. Of course, if you did enjoy this, you can check out more episodes of our podcast. We got a giant playlist on YouTube for the YouTube versions. You can see us, all of our lovely faces on screen, but we also have a fantastic podcast, anchor.fm. We got a brilliant playlist on there. We have book coverage and also show coverage. So if you're someone who's looking to get into The Witcher books and you want to read them, we have basically most of the first two books covered, and yeah, we're getting into more and more as we go along. We have, I believe, 20 some episodes now, so get into that. I'll put the link in the description of the video for those of you who want to go check that out, and I will also put the links in the description of the video for these two lovely people. They also create content as well, but I'll let them tell you all about that. So yeah, content creators we have here. What kind of content creation is going on for you, Aziz?
Well, I'm still working the things over at History of Westeros, and we are getting ready to do a Valar re-readis for Fire and Blood. So that is just getting started in a couple of weeks as of this recording. So that's fun. That'll be the majority of my Song of Ice and Fire podcasting for the next several months. So looking forward to that. It's a great book, and looking forward to covering it.
For those of you who are into House of the Dragon or want to get into it, definitely want to go check out those videos. Nice. Usually do your streams on Sunday, correct, Aziz?
Yep, you got Excellent. It.
And Miguel.
Sorry, I have to say this. If only you had another book to...
If only, yeah.
How many years? Wasn't it like the 12-year anniversary or something like the other day?
Yeah.
House of Dragons?
It was. I think it was July 12th. Yeah. Anyway.
I'm just not going to make a comment about that. I just want
Ironically, the Hollywood writer strike will probably give George more time to write his, you know, book. So, but we'll see about that.
He was going to do that anyways, I think.
Yeah. Hopefully.
He's on his own terms, man.
I'm on a couple podcasts. I'm on this podcast. I'm on a podcast called Level 7 Access, where I think we are maybe talking about Secret Invasion, although I'm not really watching that. I also have a show called Nice Jewish Fangirls that hasn't updated in a while, but we might go back to that soon-ish. And I'm also on Twitter for now. I don't know. I've said that like a million times, so...
It's not even called that anymore.
Oh, God. I don't even want to. I can't even with that. But what I do want even to get into is I want Mikal, please say you're covering Ahsoka.
I'm sure we'll be covering Ahsoka, yeah.
Okay, cool. I want to collaborate with you on that because I will be covering it, and I'm like, this is Ahsoka is my favorite Star Wars character other than Obi-Wan, so I'm like really excited.
Yeah, Yeah. And if you want to find me online, INKASRAIN, Inkasrain is usually my handle on various places, wherever you end up.
In the description of the video, go click and be nice, or else Yennefer will send daggers after you. No, just kidding. Thanks for coming, everyone. We're really excited to be back. There will be more episodes. So this is episode one. Like I said, we will be going over all of the episodes of season three and part one and two of The Witcher. So yeah, be on the lookout for those. And if you did enjoy this, feel free to subscribe, leave a comment, and let us know what you enjoyed about these episodes. Thanks for watching, everyone. Have yourselves a lovely day. Cheers.